Welcome. On behalf of the HILS Program on Governance and the Center for Strategic and International Studies, my name is Jerry Hyman. I'm the head of the HILS Program. Welcome. On your right is Andrew Wilder, who has spent something around 30-some-odd years in Afghanistan, and on your left, Pakistan and Afghanistan. Sorry. A devotee of the Durand Line. And on your left is David Garner from Management Systems Incorporated. Andrew's with Tufts. As I said, I'm with CSIS and the HILS Program on Governance. Welcome to a session on Afghanistan. I don't know if there are any reporters or not, but we'd kind of like to hold this off the record if we could, just so we can say what we actually think. Since between them they've got somewhere around 70 years in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and I've got about 3 months, I'm going to start the conversation. I think that's called the short straw. We're going to talk a bit, and what we like to do today is actually have a conversation. We're going to present some things as if we really believe them, and we sort of believe them, but we're playing around with these ideas, these tensions. And so, number one, we're going to try to hold the fights among ourselves to a civilized level, because we've been discussing, arguing, et cetera, for a number of months now. And what we are hoping to do is present some things that we wouldn't want to have to defend to the last bit, but which we hope will engender a conversation that's a little bit different than the usual conversations about Afghanistan. We're going to try to put some things in a bit of a different context. So we'd like to play with some ideas in a way and see what you think of them, and maybe you can help us, respond to us, et cetera, et cetera. So it's, although it's in the form of some more didactic presentations here, we really are hoping to get a conversation going. And what we've talked about, or what the idea here is, competing, what we call competing visions and divided outcomes. But we couldn't agree on that either, so we had the following titles amongst ourselves for about 2 days. Fragmented visions, divided outcomes. Fragmented visions, uncertain outcomes. Competing visions, competing outcomes. Competing visions, contradictory outcomes. Conflicting visions, conflicting outcomes. Competing visions, contradictory outcomes. Divided visions, divided outcomes, and so on. So if the Afghans can't agree about the Afghan state, we can't even agree about a title. So even the title is a little bit tenuous, but I take responsibility for finally having put it down on paper. And so please hold me responsible for that. A lot of this material comes out of long time in Afghanistan, not just the last time that we were there. And we are want to concentrate, if we can, about the in the governance area of what's going on in Afghanistan. And in a way to divide our discussion between divisions and differences, tensions, whatever, within the Afghan community, and then between Afghans and the international community, and to some extent within the international community. So I'll start out, the first thing to say is that I think there are two areas at least of consensus in the area that we are talking about. The first is, and this was almost universal, when we asked about, and when we've talked to people there now on this last trip, but before that as well, what are the things that are problematic, what are the things that bother you? Almost universally, we got three answers to which we want to come back at the end. Security, justice, and good governance. Almost everybody mentioned those three. It didn't matter how high or low socioeconomically or how broad geographically. Those are the three things that got put on the table. And it's not coincidental or accidental that the Taliban are talking about exactly these things. And so I want to come back to them as we go through our discussion, come back at the end. The second agreement is on a continued commitment to an Afghan state. And there was a time 20 years ago, 30 years ago, whenever, when people were talking about whether the state would disintegrate, whether the groups would divide up, et cetera, et cetera. And we don't think any of that is there now. There, we will come to the question of tensions between these groups, but the Uzbeks are not proposing to hive off and go to Uzbekistan. The Tajiks aren't planning to go to Tajikistan. The Shia are not suggesting that they should be part of Iran, and so on. There is a broad commitment to probably a pretty central, probably pretty strong Afghan state. The tensions come in what constitutes that state. What's the nature of that state? What's the nature of Afghan society that people are committed to? And I want to talk about three of them. And Andrew and David will talk about a couple of others. The first is some difference, and again, we're polarizing this more than is the case when you actually talk to people. Most people are somewhere in the middle on all these tensions. But the first is, to some extent, a tension between centralization and decentralization. How much of a centralized state should there be? How much of a decentralized state? Since Abdul Rahman Khan in the 19th century, there's been a nominally centralized Afghan state. But much of it has been decentralized all the way along. And then during the period of the Mujahideen, things got chaotic and, if you want to put it this way, decentralized. But that carried with it a lesson for Afghans about the dangers of decentralization, and almost nobody wants to go back to that. Nevertheless, And the reaction to the decentralization and the withdrawal and the warlords and so on is, again, a recommitment to an Afghan state that is basically centralized. And the Loya Jirga reinforced that with no small amount of help from the United States and other international well-wishers, who in the Constitution created a much more centralized state with much greater powers probably than there was before. And the centralizers want to create in substance, not just in form, what the realization of the constitutional vision of a central Afghan state. And so there's been a growing centralization in finance, appointment powers, projects, appointments, et cetera, into Kabul. And in the Kabul ministries, at least, a commitment to the realization of a central Afghan state with much control from Kabul. So, for example, you go to the local levels and the decision about what to do in water or what to do in agriculture or whatever, those all come from the line ministries. And that's where the money is, and that's where the authorities are, and that's where the people are seconded from or detailed from. And so these decisions go back to Kabul, and the people in Kabul are among the main actors in trying to create this much more centralized state in fact as well as in theory. When asked about decentralization, they either grow pale, angry, whatever. Say, look, in the first place, we're just getting started on the centralization project. Now you want to talk about decentralization, the we being, of course, the international donors. At the very least, let us get the central government set up, and then we can worry about decentralization. Not that we don't want to do some decentralization, it's just that we don't want to start there, and we don't want to switch horses in the middle of the road. Moreover, decentralizing would be destabilizing. We've got all these folks out there, and you're engendering yet another element of destabilization into the picture. If you come and talk now about going outside of Kabul, creating local decentralized ministries and so forth and so on, it is too destabilizing to do it now. Let us build a central state, and then we can talk about decentralization. And to that extent, it's a sequencing issue more than it is a conceptual issue. But they're related to one another, because the centralizers, first of all, most centralizers are not known for wanting to give power up once they've gotten it. And secondly, there's no timetable here, and they really want to build a central state. Those who ask for more decentralization or think of more decentralization are usually outside of Kabul most often, and particularly in the non-Pashtun areas. And for them, so they tend to be representatives of sort of the more the not majority or the not plurality part of the population. And they say, look, what's really destabilizing is this attempt to draw all the power back into Kabul, because we don't want to do things all the same all over the country. The Pashtuns want to do things one way. We do things somewhat different way. Why does everything have to be done at the same time, in the same way, in the same place? Why does the curriculum have to be the same? Does everybody have to be teaching things in the same way on the same day, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? That's what's destabilizing. If you push us from Kabul too much, you're going to force us into potentially finding differences between ourselves. And we agree that there should be an Afghan state, but we think there should be more decentralization, and it shouldn't be waiting for some long time down the road. There are variations among the groups, and we want to have some things done centrally and other things done not centrally. So defense, finance, foreign affairs, and things like that definitely should be done centrally. Other things, education perhaps, et cetera, should be done more decentrally. Recently, the U.S. and other international donors have also been pushing decentralization for a variety of other reasons, which we'll come to momentarily. But they are, from the point of view of the centralizers, engendering this destabilizing element into the system. So the first question is, how central and decentral should the state be? The second, which is somewhat related but also somewhat different, and where we're having a bit of trouble putting our hands on around exactly what we mean, is the difference between a formal and modern state and a more traditionally based state. To some extent, that mirrors the central-decentral argument, but not entirely. The Westernizers, if you want to put it that way, including the donors usually, want to try to build a rule-based set of institutions. You know, things ought to be done in a transparent way. There ought to be merit promotions. There ought to be merit recruitment. There ought to be if we're talking about the Ministry of X, it ought to look like the Ministry of X in lots of other places. What we want to build here is a modern Afghan state. The traditional system, of course, was much more personalized, much more based on institutions of kinship, ethnicity, shuras, jurgas, you know, elders, graybeards, as they say. And to some extent, but we'd like to use this value-laden way, patronage, in the sense that you are part of a kin group and your kin group looks out for you and you look out for them, and client-patron relationships, there are, you know, malaks and so on, and you owe loyalty to the malak and the malak represents you and so on. One could have a centralized traditional system, but that's not what the modernizers are about, and that's not what the centralizers are about either. And yet this rational set of institutions is built on a series of relationships that are quite traditional in their nature, quite personalized in their nature. And so although people say they want to build a traditional contemporary centralized state, what they're actually doing in many cases is taking resources and using them in a very traditional kind of a way. Who are you? Who are you to me? Who's your cousin? Who am I? What's your cousin getting? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that creates a bit of a conflict, at least from the international perspective and from also within Afghanistan among Afghans, as to what the rules actually are. And it leads to not a small number of accusations about the use of state resources for what might otherwise be called traditional purposes, and which, if they were done at the local village level, would be an acceptable way to do business. However, The traditional rules, first of all, constrained the ability to do these things. It wasn't, you didn't just give money to your or resources to your cousin. There were all kinds of rules about how you shared these things within the community. And those things are not so well, those constraints are not so well entrenched in Kabul as they are in local villages. And secondly, the traditional systems have been dying off for quite some time. First of all, the war itself brought an end to a lot of that. Moloks and you know, Arbabs and so on and so forth were killed off by warlords. And warlords used their booty to take the place of traditional leaders in even in villages. So who's left at the traditional level are not the same people who would have been there had there not been the kind of civil unrest that we found in the 1970s, 80s, 90s. And secondly, in a globalizing world in which people are emigrating, migrant workers are sending remittances back, people are leaving their, not just the cities, but the villages, people are coming and going, they're bringing things back. The idea of a traditional system, even in the rural village areas, is no longer what it once was. There's too many. There are too many radios, televisions, CDs, et cetera, to think that these things are left intact. And nevertheless, there's a kind of the co-optation of the mechanisms of the modern state in the formal system for traditional ways of gaining power. And if you're in charge of the ministries, who gets the booty, who gets the resources, et cetera, from your ministry? People want to be in ministries that have resources that they can redistribute. And there is really a growing sense in the center of patronage systems with group interests and individual interests that are impinging on these contemporary, more westernized forms. So neither are working very well. Neither the westernization attempt nor the traditional attempt are working very well, except if you're part of the increasingly oligopolized elite, which is capturing a whole series of rent kinds of behaviors, including the resources of the state, the drugs and drug trafficking, some criminal ties to criminal elements, and even to some extent to the Taliban. And so a narrowing nexus, we're calling it, of oligopolistic actors taking over the illicit parts of the economy, but also the licit part of the government and also of the economy, forcing out competitors, cement, trucking, hotels, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what seems to us a dangerous small group of people at the center capturing resources and using them to gain control without competition, without as much constraint as there might have been either in the traditional system or in what is supposed to be the checks and balances of this modernized system. The third area of tension, of course, is between ethnic groups. All ethnic groups, but particularly between the Pashtun on the one hand and the non-Pashtun on the other. But again, that's a conceptual construct because the non-Pashtuns are divided amongst themselves, Tajiks, Hazaras, Uzbeks, etc., etc., etc. And yet, to some extent, it is seen as a Pashtunness versus non-Pashtun division because the Pashtun are the largest group by far, not the majority, but by far the largest group, and also because the insurgency is dominated by Pashtun actors. It's not by no means the case that every Pashtun sympathizes with the Taliban, probably a minority do, But it is the reverse is the case, that most of the Taliban are Pashtuns. And so to some extent that fuels the ethnic divisions in the state and tends to bring up remind people of the period in the Mujahideen period when the northern groups and the western groups were kind of allied against Kabul. So three areas of tension: modernizing or whatever versus traditional, central versus decentral, and ethnic. Those are the first set. David?
Okay, well, the stuff that I'm going to talk about today is somewhat simpler than the conceptual stuff that Jerry was going over. We were doing a lot of different things when we were out in Afghanistan, but I'm just going to go over some of the socioeconomic and demographic and cultural challenges that I think Afghanistan is going to be facing over the next several years. Many of us are at least passively aware of a lot of these variables, but if you start putting these things together, the variables begin to look like they kind of snowball, and it begins to suggest a rather worrisome trend. Just in terms of some basics, Afghanistan, as most of you know, is the fifth least developed country in the world. It's supposed to have the second lowest life expectancy and the second lowest adult literacy rate in the world. Somewhere between cumulatively 24 to 28% of the population of Afghanistan is purportedly literate. That includes women as well as men. If you factor it out, the men are obviously somewhat more literate than the women. That's just background. But there's three sets of variables. One is population growth together with the youth bulge. One is employment, and one is urbanization. And these three variables begin to start, it looks like they're starting to coalesce in fairly significant ways. I should say that all the numbers that I throw out today for what they're worth are at best guesstimations. Almost all numbers in Afghanistan are essentially notional, but I think they convey some kind of an order of magnitude that's probably useful. When you look at the population of Afghanistan, you get various estimations. We used to say 40 years ago it was 15 million plus or minus a couple of million. Today you can more or less say it's 30 million plus or minus a couple of million. I've seen estimates from 26 million to 33 million. I use a figure of 30 million just as a point of reference. most women, family sizes are large, as I think you all know. Most women have somewhere between 6 and 8 children during their lifetime. The net population growth seems to be somewhere between 2.5% and 3%. What this tends to suggest is that by 2015, you're probably looking at maybe 35 million Afghans or something in that neighborhood. By 2020, you may be looking at 40 to 45 million Afghans. You look at the resource base there is for those people to support those people, and there ain't very much there to feed them. If you think about the youth bulge, people are familiar with the term. Usually we're talking here about people between the ages of 15 and 29. Afghanistan is an extremely young country. It appears that the median age for both men and women is somewhere around 17 and a half years. But this gets worse because approximately 45% of the population seems to be under the age of 15. Somewhat more than 70% of the population seems to be under the age of 30. Some people say as much as 75% of the population is under the age of 30. In current terms, this is probably 10 million Afghans. This is a lot of people in the youth bulge from 15 to 29. If you start to think about employment for these people, we get figures that suggest something like 40% of the population of the country is unemployed. I suspect that number may be an underestimation. That's not counting underemployment. I don't think it's counting seasonal unemployment, because in many parts of the country you can't work in the winters. So unemployment is a major variable. If you go next door into the federally administered tribal agencies, FATA in Pakistan, you've got numbers over there that suggest that you've got 60% unemployment. That's a benchmark for what it's worth. It may be more accurate than the 40% that you sometimes hear for unemployment across Afghanistan. Anytime you're looking at those kinds of numbers, you can always disaggregate them by age, by sex, by gender, by ethnicity, and so on and so on. As we know in the United States, black unemployment's a lot higher than white unemployment right now, and you could probably do the same thing with Hazara unemployment and things like that. The third variable that I think is really important to keep in mind is urbanization as a trend in Afghanistan. Because most people, I think, tend to think of Afghanistan as still a bunch of scattered little villages, and that increasingly no longer seems to be the case. The estimates for the urban population typically range around 25 to 30%. This would, if you assume roughly 30 million people, this is already 7.5 to 9 million people. The Minister for Urban Development says that the urban population in Afghanistan is growing by 5% a year. By 2020, you're probably looking at something in the neighborhood of 15 million people, 40% of the population, living in urban areas. When I first went to Afghanistan 40 years ago, that was the total population of the country. Now it's going to be the urban population in a few years. If you look at Kabul as an urban area, some estimates say that in 2001, Kabul had a population of less than 1 million. Today it probably has a population of something like 4 million. There was a recent JICA study that says by 2020 you're going to have a population there of roughly 6 million people. More than half the population of the country already seems to live, more than half the urban population of the country already seems to live in Kabul. And the growth rates there seem to have been substantially faster than in other conurbations like Dhaka, like Lagos, Karachi, Jakarta, Mumbai. Kabul has been growing much, much, much faster than even those places. So if you start to put all these things together, it looks to me like you're looking at something like a trifecta. And let me give you a mnemonic device that is an oversimplification, but it begins to suggest an order of magnitude. Sometime between 2015 and 2020, you're probably going to be looking at a population somewhere around 40 million people, maybe more than 40 million people. You're looking at more than 40% unemployment. You're looking at 40% urbanized populations. I don't want to overstate this, but you have the potential here for something equivalent to political nuclear fusion. You get all this stuff together in these urban areas, and you're looking at potential explosions. As more people move into the cities, there's going to be increasing urban unemployment. Poverty and unemployment will continue to grow. The social tensions, you can imagine what this has done with this measure of urbanization. Cultural values are changing, traditional norms are weakening, crimes of violence are increasing. I think Jerry touched on this, but we'll say it again. I think it's important. Over the last few decades, a lot of Afghanistan's traditional leadership has been decimated. Again, as a benchmark, over in Fatah, in the last few years, 600 tribal leaders have been systematically assassinated. This stuff has been happening across the country. I've heard other figures for the Hazar Jat. We don't have figures. I don't have figures for the east, for eastern Afghanistan, but I think it's fairly significant. Andrew has pointed out that the Taliban have systematically liquidated moderate mullahs at a much greater rate than they have liquidated khans or maliks or arbabs. These are worrisome trends. In addition to this, things like class divisions between the haves and the have-nots are growing almost daily. Some Afghans are suggesting that there's a growing gap between the generations, with youth showing less respect for older people. When you start looking at urbanization, it's almost certain that alienation will continue to grow. As Afghans move into these urban areas, you're losing some of the checks and balances that existed in more traditional societies, particularly in smaller communities where everybody knew one and everybody else. People become anonymous, and they have the alienation that goes along with the anonymity. In this kind of an environment, social, political, and religious movements will tend to flourish, propelled in many cases by different interpretations of Islam. Jobless young men looking for meaning in their lives can drift into jihadist terrorist movements. They can turn to gang violence or other kinds of political action. We know that drug addiction is a growing problem across Afghanistan. There are numbers that suggest that you've got perhaps close to 1 million people addicted to hard substances, heroin and opium. There's another figure that suggests you may have another 1 million people addicted to psychotropics. That's 2 million people out of a population of roughly 30 million people. You may, going beyond this, be looking at increasing emotional problems. We know that a lot of Afghans have been suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, things like that. That was from the war. As you move into urbanization, you'll be looking at different kinds of emotional phenomena, but it looks like this is a growing problem. You may, as you move into these urbanized communities, be looking at something like a collapse of family structures, or what sometimes around here we call them family values in the United States. So just to summarize, Afghanistan is no longer a collection of poor, illiterate, isolated rural villages. You've got a substantial growing underclass that's no longer isolated in scattered rural communities. At the present time, the insurgency across the country is still mostly a rural phenomenon, but I think it's important to point out that there's a good chance that this thing could become more of an urban phenomenon. What we've been seeing in Mingora, in Swat, in the newspapers here in the last few days, could easily begin to show up in Kunduz, in Mazar, in Herat, in Kabul, certainly across the east and in the south. So think about trifecta, think about these growing trends, and factor them in as you start watching Afghanistan. Thank you.
Anyway, thank you, Jerry, for organizing this, and thank you, CSIS, for giving me a forum to present. I'm going to be focusing on presenting some very preliminary findings from research I've been doing for the past year at Tufts University, looking at the assumption that reconstruction aid has a stabilization benefit. This is a very central assumption. It's having a big impact both on aid policy as well as our counterinsurgency policies. And there's several assumptions that I want to sort of look at, and I don't probably won't have time to go over all of them, but some of these include one assumption is that reconstruction programs and modernization efforts in general are stabilizing rather than destabilizing. One is that poverty and a lack of reconstruction are significant causes or drivers of conflict in Afghanistan. Another assumption seems to be that aid projects make you popular and help win hearts and minds. And a fourth assumption is extending the reach of the central government in Afghanistan contributes to stabilization. And this, the objective of PRTs in Afghanistan is to extend the reach of the central government, presumably on the assumption that that does have a stabilizing benefit. So again, it is a very important assumption. It's reflected in the new sort of Army Stability Operations Manual. It's reflected in common phrases like aid and security are two sides of the same coin. And often, you know, the slow pace of reconstruction is often given as one of the major causes of the deteriorating security situation and as something fueling the insurgency in Afghanistan. And again, the impact is having other some very major impacts. The first one is that there's lots more money for reconstruction. The aid and development sector is flourishing financially in countries like Afghanistan because of the assumption that it has a security benefit. Another impact is that as more money is being spent in insecure areas, the military and civil military outfits like PRTs are doing much more of the implementation than traditional development actors. So I think in 2007, for example, just out of the SERP funding, we had about $500 million of SERP funding going through the PRTs in Afghanistan. And a third impact is that an increasing percentage of U.S. development assistance is programmed based on stabilization and security considerations rather than the basis of poverty or need-based criteria. Now, of course, historically, there's always been, you know, political and security considerations, you know, determining, you know, having a big impact in where U.S. government funding has been spent, was being spent, certainly in the Cold War era. We saw that. But I would argue that currently in countries like Afghanistan, you're seeing a much greater move in that direction, a much more focus of U.S. government resources of working in what are termed as non-permissive environments versus the permissive environments, or if you see the UN security maps, the red zones as opposed to the yellow or green zones. In 2007, for example, I don't have last year's figures, but I think in 2007, USAID assistance, more than 50% of it was spent in four provinces in the south out of 34 provinces in Afghanistan. And between 2002 and 2007, I saw one UN figure showing U.S. government funding in Helmand alone exceeded all the USAID funding in the northern region of Afghanistan. So, again, very much having an impact on where our assistance is going. And this, of course, does not go unnoticed in Afghanistan. Anyone who's traveled in central Afghanistan or northeast Afghanistan or the northern region, you know, every meeting you have with governors and government officials and also the public is complaining about why are we being penalized? You know, we don't have Taliban, so we're not getting any money. And so we have these perverse incentives, in a way, of rewarding the insecure areas with our development assistance and penalizing the secure ones. So again, that's, I think, the impact of the assumption. And I think what my research is trying I'm trying to find evidence of stabilization benefit from our reconstruction programs. And to date, it's been hard to find that. And it's interesting to me that there's been a lot of emphasis on aid effectiveness and a very, you know, rich debate on aid effectiveness going on. But to a considerable extent, the aid effectiveness debate gets restricted to aid's effectiveness in achieving humanitarian and development objectives. But when such a significant percentage of our aid resources are programmed to achieve political and security objectives, I think there's a real need that the aid effectiveness discussion should also look at what is aid's effectiveness in achieving our political and security objectives. So that's been the focus of the research. And as I said, it's not coming up with a lot of evidence that there is a stabilization benefit from our current reconstruction programs. For starters, there's not much historical evidence. If you look back in Afghanistan's history, it's actually been the times when we've been trying to promote or the Afghan state has tried to promote modernization, which have been the times of greatest instability. I mean, you can look at the efforts of King Amanullah to promote, push a modernization agenda in the 1920s, and it basically, you know, contributed to his overthrow. It's also important to remember that from 1950 to 1979, USAID had a massive program in Afghanistan. And in fact, in Afghanistan in the 60s is one of the largest per capita recipients of donor assistance in the world due to the Cold War efforts to win hearts and minds in Afghanistan. And I recently came across a very interesting USAID review done in 1988 looking at what was the impact of USAID programming from 1950 to 1979 in Afghanistan. And it came up with an interesting quote. one of the conclusions was the use of aid for short-term political objectives in the competition with the Soviet Union in Afghanistan tended to distort sound economic rationale for development, and in the process to weaken the longer-term political interests of the United States. Aid as a tool of diplomacy has its limitations when politically motivated commitments are at a much higher level and promise more than can reasonably be delivered in economic returns. And I think that that's, you know, certainly a lesson that we could be learning for today. But also the Soviets, I think if you look at the Soviet period in the 1980s, made major investments in also infrastructure programming, also as a part of their stabilization efforts. And I think fairly consistent finding, looking back through Afghanistan history, is that the efforts to use aid to achieve political and security objectives have consistently failed. A second reason to question the assumption is that if you do look at, again, data in Afghanistan is deeply flawed, but if you look at what data we have in terms of poverty mapping, there's not a strong correlation between poverty and insecurity in Afghanistan. I mean, if you look at the poorest region, say Hazarajat, it's, you know, it tends to be probably the most stable region of Afghanistan. So the assumption that poverty itself is a major driver of conflict in Afghanistan, I think, lacks evidence. A third thing is that we've now had PRTs on the ground since late 2002, early 2003. We have 26 in Afghanistan. I think over $500 million in projects and over 1,000 projects totaling $500 million have been completed, and another 4,740 projects worth another $600 million are in the pipeline. So, again, quite a track record, quite an investment of projects. But there is, again, no evidence from PRT projects that these projects have had a stabilization benefit. And that, we need to acknowledge, it's extremely difficult to show benefit. Measuring, you know, the impact of stabilization, is extremely difficult. There's so many independent variables. It's especially difficult, I think, if you're trying to do it using quantitative techniques, as the military tends to do. So this isn't, you know, so it is extremely difficult, but nevertheless, we don't have much evidence that this investment in projects has had a significant stabilizing benefit. My study is also not just looking at U.S. military efforts. It's also other aid actors. I'm looking in particular at some UNAMA projects. UNAMA has had, for example, in Paktia province, something called the Zadran Arc Stabilization Initiative running since about 2005, and a very well thought through program to try to do some work to promote stabilization. And you know, there is some evidence that this project helped develop some relationships at the local level. But overall, there doesn't seem to have been a significant stabilization benefit from it. And then out of my research, and this is anyone who's worked in Afghanistan, certainly in the development sector, I think will have had a similar experience, is that in before, you know, turning to academia, I was working in the development sector for a long time. And one of the lessons from that time is that you shouldn't do development work to become popular. It more often than not irritates people. But out of the research, the findings that are coming in, I'm doing a study basically on perceptions of aid in Afghanistan in these areas where we've been investing these resources. The first complaint you hear is nothing has been done. Very common accusation in Afghanistan. Nothing has been done. Second one, not enough has been done. A third one, they got more than we did. And in a zero-sum society, that's very common. This, you'd build a well here, well, 10 other villages are unhappy you didn't build wells there. A lot of complaints, well, what was done was poor quality. You know, they built a graveled road. We wanted a tarmacked road. What has been done is inappropriate. They're building schools and clinics. What we really need is factories and dams. A lot of complaints about corruption, both contractors, of government, of NGOs, and of PRTs. Lots of money is wasted. All these internationals, tremendous costs, subcontracting and the sub-subcontracting. Lots of broken promises. PRTs came by, the last PRT commander came, and they promised us this, and then they moved on, and the next person said he never heard of it. Nothing was done. Too little employment of local workers. And I think the faceless contracting mechanisms we use often do, I think, exacerbate the situation. Too little consultation with local communities. I mean, I'm going on and on just to give you a sense that in the research, you very, very rarely come across someone saying, I am very grateful for all the wonderful work you have done in our community. And I think there's a tactic here involved as well. But this idea that somehow what we're doing wins hearts and minds, I mean, I don't like that phrase, but I think we need to be a bit careful about how that plays out. I think even if there was some kind of benefit, I think you have to question what would be the sustainability of that benefit. Maybe when we're building a $300 million road from Kabul to Kandahar, maybe it did provide some employment. Maybe during that period of tremendous investment, there was, you know, there were some benefits. But you know, now that's a road none of us can drive down. So how long is that effect? And lastly, just to talk about a little about the idea that perhaps a lot of our work, not only is it not contributing to stabilization, but it actually could be destabilizing. And I'm trying to do a bit more work on the political economy of aid. But there's a strong argument I think to have is that the more money we try to push through a system with weak institutions and very limited human resources, the more that spills over into fueling corruption. And the whole business of contracting is actually a very, very dirty and dangerous business in Afghanistan these days. Many of these contracting companies have links back to top levels of government. As the more money we push through this, especially in the big road building projects, the stakes get higher and higher. There's significant evidence that percentages of our U.S. aid and PRT contracts go to pay off the Taliban as protection money so that our workers on the roads don't get killed. There's significant evidence of contracting companies creating insecurity for their rival contracting companies. Recently heard of a case of one contractor who bid lower than another influential contractor and won the bid and was subsequently gunned down so that the influential contractor then got, you know, was the lowest bidder. So a lot of those kind of dynamics, I think, are at play and I think not surprising. So just to conclude, I mean, I think that, you know, security is the number one issue in Afghanistan today, and I think that if there is evidence that these reconstruction projects are having a significant stabilization benefit, then I, for one, certainly think we should be focusing our resources into insecure areas where they're going to have the stabilization benefit. What I am saying, though, is that I have not come across evidence, I'm not aware of much evidence that these projects are having a stabilization benefit. And if they aren't having a stabilization benefit, maybe we should be redirecting our development resources to the more stable parts of the country where you could actually do more development in a much more cost-effective manner because you don't have to pay for the tremendous overheads and costs of security and I'd likely get more bang for your buck, not to mention maybe rewarding security rather than our current policy of penalizing it. Thank you.
To wrap things up, just to go over some of this, centralization versus decentralization, modern versus traditional, ethnic tensions, urbanization, globalization, unemployment, drugs, permissive versus non-permissive areas, aid effectiveness, et cetera, what do they come to? Seems to us three things. First, very little checks and balances on the cartels that are growing. Very few, even in the supposedly modern system that we're setting up, there's no middle class. Parliament, or very small middle class, I should say. Parliament is weak. The courts are weak. Media are grown a bit. It's become dangerous to do too many investigative journalist kinds of stories. And so you ask yourself, well, if there's a cartelization, oligopolization of resources, where are the checks on this thing? What stops it from just snowballing? Secondly, if you're an Afghan in that situation, what should be your rational response? Trust is very low. Zero-sum game mentality growing. And a sense among the elite, particularly, but among everybody, that you should get yours, get it quickly, and get out. And the people who can get out are the people with the dual passports and the families and the mansions and so on outside. But the ordinary Afghan knows the same lesson, just can't get it. A fellow that helped me out in Herat, young fellow, struggling just out of school, wanted, first and last question is, can you help me get out? Lastly, to return to the initial consensus about what the problems are, security, justice, and good governance. What are these things doing to address those three issues? The Taliban is here to tell you that they've got an answer to those three issues. And the question is, do we? Thanks.
Thank you. With regards to your last statement, as far as the oligopoly that exists in the cartels, why is our government in the United States and our media actually giving the impression that the Karzai regime is going to continue and that we tacitly support this? That doesn't seem to be in the interest of stabilization or security or our other goals. Thank you.
Thank you. My question is actually about the Arbakis, or the local police that basically the United States is supporting with the actually working together with the Ministry of Internal Affairs in Afghanistan and their establishment. How does they help the process of security and stability in Afghanistan? Thank you.
Mind if I sit in your lap? I'm Brian Jolkowski from Mercy Corps. And first, thank you very much for your observations, which I think are very interesting, pretty thought-provoking, pretty depressing. And in terms of some of the last observations, I think things that the NGO community has been trying to articulate in terms of some of our concerns about how the U.S. and international community are approaching the challenge of Afghanistan and now Afghanistan and Pakistan. Just to start off, to add a corollary to Mr. Wilder's, you don't do development to be popular. I think in some of the places we work in Afghanistan, you actually have to be popular to do effective development. So there is an element of establishing deeper relationships and credibility and presence in communities to be able to work at all. And I'm thinking in particular in the very unstable places like Helmand, Kandahar in the east. So there's some relevance there as well. In terms of what you've said, I think the point about the question about where one emphasizes and puts their resources is a really important one. I mean, there is a trend in Afghanistan now of growing instability and disillusionment throughout the country, even in the stable places. And it's a real question for policymakers, you know, do you try to stabilize and develop the places where you really can do more meaningful long-term and sustainable development, while perhaps you seek in the longer term, because it's a very long-term project in the unstable South and East, do you try to hold in some ways those and focus on the more long-term, whereas you take advantage of what you actually can do in other places? And thanks for raising that. In terms of questions, first on the aid effectiveness issue, one of the things NGOs have been struggling with is actually how to demonstrate our own effectiveness. I mean, that's true for any development actor, and it's an incredible challenge. But have you been able to identify any types of aid or approaches that you find are more effective in your data at this point, or is that something that you feel you can actually get some some substantive results on. And the second question is to the last point that was made about the Taliban being there, talking about and providing security, governance, and justice. That's an interesting question, if you wouldn't mind expanding on that, because I think some of our experience in a number of these communities is the Taliban isn't necessarily providing substitute social services and governance. It sometimes provides alternative justice systems, which is clearly very lacking in a lot of communities. But it's interesting if you found evidence of them actually providing social services and governance as a replacement for what a government normally would. Thanks.
Okay, maybe I'll just start with the last one. In terms of ways that maybe are perceived to be more effective than others. First of all, in terms of the popularity issue, as you probably know in Afghanistan, the word on NGOs, it's not good news there either. I mean, in the studies is that NGOs are also very unpopular aid actors in the interviewing I'm doing. And this is also with NGOs who have been there for 20 years doing very, very good work, I think, in some of these environments. But that doesn't necessarily mean that people like them. And there's, I think, a general sense of disillusionment with the whole aid scene. But that said, some of the programs that are viewed as most effective, and certainly in the research we're doing, is National Solidarity Program. NSP has come out, you know, more consistently than just about any other program as something that's generally, you know, with some notable exceptions, fairly well perceived. And then a couple other programs. And what is the consistent finding is that more important than the product nearly is the process. And NSP is a program with a lot of process, as are, I think, many other NGOs or community development programs. And it's the process of building relationships, which I think is the critical thing, and sustaining relationships. And I think that's one of the problems with the current PRT programs is that generally they'll go around, projects will be identified, or district officials will come in and say, we want this, and then they'll go do assessment, and then it's put out for tender. And then sealed envelopes come, and it's all a bit of a, you know, there's not, relationships aren't being built in this process. A contract is awarded, contractor goes, does the project, and then they leave. And a lot of people complained about that. And I think it's the process of building those relationships that have made NSP and sustaining them come across out more positively perceived than many of the other programs. That said, there isn't evidence that the NSP projects themselves have led to increased stability in these areas. And so I would add a cautionary note on that. But I think in terms of good development practice, those are better perceived. On the question of the Arbok, I think to me that is a good example of maybe some of the confused or contradictory or the tensions within our own U.S. government policies, where on the one hand we want to build formal security institutions of the state and are investing tremendous amounts of money in building the ANA and the ANP, but we feel we sort of, that's taking too long, so let's look for a quick fix solution, which we've tried before, incidentally, in terms of auxiliary police forces, which were fairly disastrous experience. I think we're piloting it in a few provinces. But, you know, I personally feel that whereas it could work in Loyapuktia and a few provinces in Afghanistan, it's a very dangerous model to roll out much more beyond that. But that's my own personal view on that.
Two other questions that came up are actually three. One is the question of the local police. No doubt, you'd have to have you need to have a local police no matter where you are for security. Problem is, at least in our experience, the local police are perceived to be riddled by corruption. The police forces. Perceived to be riddled by corruption, and is it providing the kind of security that people are expecting from it? Is it effective? Is it? Are these the kind of people you go to? We're proposing to increase the number of police and increase the amount of equipment and so on that they have, but without addressing, unless the one also addresses the extent to which the police are not corrupt and are responsive, you're likely to find weapons sold to the black market, a whole variety of other things, and that the police will not be perceived as the place you go to protect yourself against the Taliban. And against crime. One thing about insecurity in Afghanistan, I think, it's not just the Taliban. It's the growing amount of kidnapping, crime in the streets, et cetera, people afraid to send their kids to school. It's not just the insurgency that's creating instability and a feeling of insecurity. It's the amount of crime that isn't being dealt with, especially in the cities, but not only in the cities. So one shouldn't, I think of security only in the insurgency sense, but also in the... And the police, at least in our experience, are not places that people are going to say, we've got criminal elements in our area, can you help us? Because they're too often tied to the various criminal elements. They're by day they're doing police work, and by night they're telling people or protecting people and so on. So the question is not whether you need to build a police force. It's a question of what kind of police force you can build, and certainly it's a critical element, but it needs to be a responsive and non-corrupt police force. As to the support of the Karzai government, I think the U.S. has been sort of a bit back and forth in recent months about that. It seemed some signals were sent that they're not altogether happy with Karzai. Now people are trying to walk back a bit from that because Karzai's going to win the election, it looks like, or at least people think he's going to win the election. The more that perception is the case, the more he's likely to do it because he's making arrangements with Fahim, of all people. I mean, it's a little hard. I don't think a year ago you would have predicted that the next vice president of Afghanistan with U.S. support is going to be former Marshal Fahim, and maybe future Marshal Fahim. What are they trying to do? I think they're trying to walk a line between not supporting Karzai, but yet having to realize that they're going to live with him at the end of the day, and possibly getting the worst of both, because Afghans maybe are thinking that we are supporting Karzai, but President Karzai probably knows we're a little uncertain about that, and yet for 5 years after that, he's potentially going to be the president. So the handling of the elections and a fair game amongst fair competitors, even if he has most of the resources and certainly is using the resources of the state, will to some extent at least be redounding to his benefit, has put us probably in a quite awkward situation as far as Afghans are concerned. The last is, again, this nexus of drugs, corruption, warlords, smuggling, trafficking, drug insurgency, kidnapping, and corruption in the official areas is a terribly corrosive thing for gaining credibility in the larger Afghan community. If the major things people are saying is we need security, we need good governance, and we need justice. And I'm certainly not here suggesting that that's what the Taliban are going to actually provide, or certainly not the kind of justice I personally would want to see. But they're here to say, listen, that's what we did when we were here. We learned some lessons. We're not going to do it the same way we did it before, but look around you and ask yourself, are you better off with us than you are with them? And it seems to me, at least I won't speak for my colleagues, but I think probably for all of us, that if our eye isn't clearly on these three areas that people have said to us over and over, and every single person, these are the things that are concerning to us, all this other stuff will be churning, and we won't get to the core of the issue, which the Taliban are here to say, choose us. We know how to do this. And you might not like it so well, or not everybody will like it so well, but at least you will have justice will be done. You won't be in these long, perpetual, formal court systems, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that favor the wealthy anyway. And we will provide security, and we will provide governance and education, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's, well, not to the women and in madrasas, but, yeah, it might not be your view of what should be done.
It's not the world's view of education.
What's that?
It's not my view. It's the world's view of education. Yeah, it has to be a balanced education. Somebody cannot do arithmetic and then recite the Quran without knowing what he is saying. Is that the education that you are talking about Taliban? This is ridiculous. I was not expecting to hear this from you.
No, I have been promised the education ministry in the next Taliban administration. So I'm here to kind of support my own future employment. The question is not what we would like. Huh? Yeah, why don't we take a couple more questions? So we'll come back to that.
But one of the things that I noticed from what happened in 2007 was that we did two things. We solved the security problem, which is a lot harder to do in Afghanistan because of the terrain and the distribution of the population. And we solved a local accountability issue regarding security. We had a nationalized police force that was doing what Jerry was talking about with the sort of, you know, the central government is really sort of a cartel, and they have a set of political and economic objectives, and they're going to go out and they're going to do what they're going to do to the local population, and local population has to provide its own security, therefore militias, therefore insurgencies, multiple insurgencies. I guess I sort of look at it, and the Iraq situation, I would not say, is solved right now, but two things did get solved. Security and local accountability for security. And I wonder what the problem is with the police force, like the recruitment of the police force, because the key to the local accountability in security in Iraq was allowing the local militias to become the police. So I'd like to know what you think about the origin of these local police and if that might not be part of the solution.
Okay. Please.
Thank you for the very useful information. I'm a student from Afghanistan, and okay, I will be going back to Afghanistan in 2 weeks. I think from the beginning I had this impression that you're trying to give us some excuses for the failure in Afghanistan, and I'm sorry to say I feel like you're blaming my people for the failure. Like you talked about traditional problems, like you talked about the ethnic problems, corruption and all that stuff. But I think it's all about the commitment of the international community because they really, as an Afghan, I believe they didn't really deliver what they promised. And there was a report by Oxfam in 2007 that out of $25 billion that was promised to be delivered to Afghanistan until 2007, only $15 billion was delivered, which out of those 40% went back to the contracts by foreign companies and also advisories, high salaries for the advisors. And I think we should not expect a quick change in Afghanistan, a country that witnessed 4 invasions less than, 110 years from the Great Britain and also to Soviets. And even I assume as an Afghan that Taliban was an invasion of foreign countries, Pakistan, and of course it was a scenario by ISI. So I think things will definitely get changed if the international community provide enough support to our country and our people. And I used to work for the government. I saw change in terms of the human resources and trainings. Many of the trainings were very useful. I think if you provide more support to the people, and of course, I think it's in the agenda of the U.S. government and in international community in coming years. And I think things will definitely change in, to positive. And of course, it takes a longer time. And concerning the stabilization and reconstruction, I would suggest that I think two provinces did a good job, and I think it helped with the process. One was the Herat province until 2004, even 2005, but unfortunately President Karzai changed the governor. He brought him in Kabul and assigned him as a Minister of Power and Energy. He's a warlord. And also, I think people are very happy in Nangarhar province. The governor is a warlord, and his name is Sherzai, who was running for the presidency, but then he withdrew. So what I think it will be very useful to look at these two provinces in their profiles, and also the northern province of Balkh, which some people are happy with the governor. And also, it would be useful to look at, are there, like, if we could call good warlords that we can really use them for the reconstruction process and good leadership in Afghanistan. And go back to the issue of the centralization and decentralization. Do you think that we really did provide enough support to the centralized model that we had for Afghanistan that strengthened the centralized government, and then now we are talking about decentralization of, I mean, some aspects of the decentralization? So do you think that, did we finish the first thing? Did we provide enough support to a centralized government, and then we found out that, no, it doesn't work, and now we are talking about decentralization? Is that really, I mean, a good time to start talking about decentralization? Thank you.
Okay, Bill, you're back.
Thanks, Jerry. Those were all good comments. I just have two quick things. Going back, you go back to 2002, 2003, you could see, even that far back, that the kinds of things that you're talking about in terms of the difficulty in building these institutions, there's a lot of hubris about how far we were going to be able to go and how fast it was going to go. We're in my view, about in terms of building state institutions, about where it was possible. Where was it possible to be? In terms of the demographics, the demographic trends, that was also predictable. You could see all of those trends were going to emerge. You could look forward from way back in 2002, 2003. The drug trade, we could see that back again in 2002, 2003, 2004. You could see that was going to rise and become a serious problem. And you could even see that the safe havens were going to eventually be a problem by 2004, 2005. None of this looks good. It all looks bad. And I'm sort of left with the question of where do you see all of this headed? And it sounds, it's almost as though the tone is all of this is circling around the drain. I don't think that's where you're headed. I think that where you're headed is this: there are serious problems going forward. This is going to be a very difficult set of challenges to deal with, to sort out. Maybe we're looking at a muddling through over the next 5 or 10 years. So just a couple of thoughts on where you think this heads over the next few years, and most importantly, in the absence of what I think, in the absence of a really clear strategic vision about how to address this so far, questions out there. Is there a strategic direction for the international community, for this country, and for the Afghans to begin to really turn this around, to not simply keep muddling through? So that's a tough question. Is it circling around the drain, or is there a strategic direction that could be laid out? Whether or not you can lay that out here, obviously, is another question. Now, the other thing, I just wanted to go to quickly to Andrew's point. We talked about this last night, Andrew. What's the conclusion here in your study? Is it that ultimately there's too little evidence that the kinds of investments that we're making on the development side are ever going to really pay out in terms of improving stability, security, and therefore let's back out of that. Let's just stop making those kinds of investments. Invest in the north, invest in areas that are already secure. Is that the conclusion, or is the conclusion we have to be a lot smarter and a lot more sophisticated in the kinds of development and the ways that we do that development in those insecure areas? Those would be very different conclusions from the work that you're doing, which I think is very innovative and will be very, very useful once it's concluded.
Thank you. Paolo von Schirach, Schirach Report. Just echoing the last comment, really. But and it seems to me that this is the crux of much of what's been said. The situation in Afghanistan is bad and deteriorating, given the demographics that have been indicated and the trends that have been outlined. And the fundamental assumption that development assistance is one of the legs of the counterinsurgency stool is challenged quite strongly by the observations that have been made. Quite strong. In fact, it would appear the opposite, that the skewed amount of development assistance that's going to the most problematic provinces in Afghanistan is counterproductive, if anything. Shouldn't that indeed then lead to some basic rethinking at this point? We have an insurgency going on. We have now a new command structure that has been emplaced, essentially, with the nomination of the new commanders in the field and with a stronger focus and emphasis on counterinsurgency. Wouldn't that be wise, then, under the circumstances, whatever the noble objectives of development are, to scale back development assistance programs that are not demonstrably yielding the impact that they're supposed to, and focus on the insurgency, and think of development assistance in the areas, as you indicated, that may be more promising, where the overhead costs and all the additional externalities are now present, and therefore forget about this notion that successful development assistance at the level of the provincial reconstruction teams yields a positive impact on security and helps stabilize the areas, which, as you indicate, there's no demonstrable correlation. So wouldn't this be the moment, based on the evidence that you have collected, to rethink strategically and to say, first of all, we have an insurgency, and can we conduct counterinsurgency without the added tools which we thought were beneficial of development assistance, and focus on counterinsurgency and then rethink development and reconstruction at a later date? Would that be your policy advice to the new command structure based on the evidence you've collected so far? Thank you.
Okay. I guess it depends on how you define governance. I think that the insurgency and the collapse of the state, you know, has something to do with, has a bearing on governance issues. But I guess my first advice to policymakers is let's find the evidence before we invest so much on this assumption in terms of our COIN strategy in particular, but also in terms of development. I'm certainly not saying let's stop our development efforts. but we need more of an evidence base before we pursue that line. My own view is that I think the military component's a very important part of it. I'm not anti-PRT. I think PRTs have a role to play. But I think ultimately what's most important is the politics and the political component. And my own feeling is that we have a development component, we have a military component, but what we really don't have is a political component. And that's because, in theory, that should be the role of the Afghan government. And yet it doesn't seem to me we necessarily have a partner in terms of an Afghan government that has necessarily the same objectives as we do. And back to the governance issue, I mean, it doesn't seem to me that there's necessarily a significant constituency for reform to be pushing some of the things that need to be doing, because, frankly, a lot of the people in power now are doing pretty well out of the status quo. So perhaps we've created a situation where maintaining the status quo is the preeminent interest of the ruling class, and I think this relates to the election issue. And I think that's why I'm personally somewhat pessimistic about the future. Maybe, you know, and because I think we don't have the partner in the government, which was the essential piece to bring the political thing to the table, which we are not don't have a comparative advantage. We don't have the institutions or individuals who I think are up to the task internationally, not just in terms of the U.S. government, to do the political piece, which I think is important in a counterinsurgency program. And so I think, therefore, to show that we're taking it seriously, we say what we need is more money, and are trying to throw money at the problem in the hopes that maybe a reconstruction will cover for where we are lacking, I think, on the political side. So that's where I would go on that front. In terms of the police issue, just very briefly, there is a tendency now, especially with General Petraeus where he is, in bringing lessons from Iraq to Afghanistan, which is why I do think we are seeing actually more of a focus and more of a push towards sending more of our resources to where we have the insurgency, as well as the issue of revisiting this idea of local militias, because, you know, it did seem to work in Iraq. I do think Afghanistan is a very different environment where we don't have we have a very bad recent history of local militias, and quite a bit of effort did actually go into disarming many of those. The number one public demand in Afghanistan in 2002 was DDR. People wanted to see those militias, and it's one of the reasons, I think, what Jerry mentioned, too, why decentralization is something that many of the Afghan public don't favor, because they feel we actually tasted decentralization with a vengeance. So I think the idea of militias is a very controversial one in Afghanistan. And as I alluded to before, there's one area in Afghanistan, you know, sort of a Loya Paktia area in the east with three provinces, where the tribal system is much stronger and more cohesive and historically had much more autonomy for various reasons in terms of roles they played in supporting the king and bringing the king to the throne, where there is more tradition of local militias, this institution called Arbakai. There's a danger of trying to think, okay, well, let's take that. It's a local traditional practice and taking it to the rest of the country. And I think that's where some of the risks are. So that's why I'm personally skeptical. And again, we have a track record, again, when we tried to speed up the process of building the police force in Afghanistan, we created what was called the auxiliary police, which is give them a uniform, give them 10 days of training, and give them a new weapon, which is basically giving uniforms to militias. And it ended with disastrous consequences, and it was then disbanded. So that's my only...
We did the same thing for the first 3 years in Iraq, but there was no political link, and that was the difference. So
okay. And then finally, just on the point where the gentleman here was raising about, blaming Afghans for failure, I certainly hope that that wasn't what we said. I think the international community has a lot to blame. But I do think that there's a tendency amongst Afghans to also place too much blame always on the outsiders. I think that this is... the divisions in Afghanistan present outsiders with many opportunities to play games as well. And so I think that there's two sides to that. And the lesson I would draw from your example of stabilization in Herat and Nangarhar and Mazar is those are, of course, the three provinces where the governors were warlords. So is it their reconstruction efforts, which brought stabilization, or the fact that they were fairly scary people that maybe brought stabilization. So I'll leave it at that.
Just a couple points. I think on the question of whether it's going down the drain, or I forget what the exact analogy was there, the concern is that the trends are not in the right direction. The concern is that there's too little of an Afghan constituency for reform that is not going to be, the international community is not the right place for a constituency of reform for durable solutions in any country, and not in Afghanistan either. So unless there's a constituency to make the government accountable and to make these things work, it's a little hard to see how it's going to work. And it seems to me anyway, that a lot of the money that has gone in to Afghanistan has gone in to support a lot of the wrong places and has fueled some of the very nexus that we're talking about. To me, governance, if you want to get to that question, requires checks and balances. And if those checks and balances aren't included, aren't created, or aren't nurtured, or aren't whatever, it's the same kind of thing about the constituency reform. It seems to me you're opening up the prospect of a small number of people doing quite well here, and a large number of people continuing to do poorly and perhaps getting even more poor as we go along. So what the parliament, for example, is weak. It's lots of reasons for that. SNTV is one of them, the voting system. We're about to go into a almost endless series of elections with poor political party development, poor mechanisms of accountability internally, outside of government and inside of government. If you're going to build a Western kind of or a modern kind of state, whatever word you want to use, then you need to have the checks and balances in the institutions to make sure that they don't get corrupted by the resources that are put into them. There's very little taxation into the Afghan society, and so very few mechanisms of accountability to the citizens of Afghanistan. This is all coming in from the outside, whether it's drug exporting or taxes on imports or aid resources. These are the hallmarks of rentier states. And you can go to Nigeria, you can go to a whole variety of other rentier kinds of environments with resources concentrated in the hands of a few people, and you do not find very many cases of a traditional or modern or any other kind of accountable system. And it seems to me that if those aren't corrected, whether it's done by the international community but helping Afghan actors do it, or whether Afghan actors are going to do it themselves, the prognosis is precisely to look in a growing vortex. The centralization of economic power and political power in the hands of a few people, licit and illicit, is not a good sign for an accountable governance system, in my opinion, and one that either Afghans or non-Afghans would want to depend on for the future. I certainly hope it was not... I certainly hope people don't leave from here saying what we're in favor of is a Taliban victory. I wouldn't want to... that's not the kind of governance or services or security or whatever that I think any of us would want to see.
Might get a good Ministry of Education.
Yeah, well... I've already indicated who that's going to be. So why don't we take one more round, and I'm afraid we're going to go in the back. And then, okay, I want to make sure we get geographical accountability here.
I'm Amit Pandya from the Stimson Center. A couple of comments and then a question. I think one thing is it's worth remembering that despite its notorious divisiveness and its diversity, that Afghanistan actually has 200-plus years of successful experience of building and operating a state, a national state of some kind. And I think it's important for us to remember that, because I think that that might remind us that there are probably significantly atrophied after 30 years of civil war substantial resources in Afghan society of some kind of statecraft. It may not look like the kind of statecraft that we're accustomed to. So that's sort of one observation. The other is, it seems to me that what you've described...
You're a monarchist, I mean.
What?
Go ahead, sorry.
I'm a monarchist-Leninist, actually. That's what I am. But no, seriously. You know, the other thing, Jerry, you said, that it's not clear where the Afghan constituency for reform is. Unless I, wildly misobserve, there may not be an Afghan constituency for reform, but there is a very, very strong and widespread Afghan constituency for peace, for peacefulness, peaceability, should we say, okay? Now, here's the thing. What you've described between you is a situation where there's social vulnerability and social dissolution, there's insecurity and criminality, and poor or non-existent governance, all in the context of the presence of a very substantial number of well-armed, well-trained, incorruptible, and well-intentioned armed forces. And when you have that kind of sort of, I don't know what you want to call it, sort of, mutually reinforcing dysfunction, where despite the presence of, billions of dollars of donor resources, all those soldiers and all of that, you have essentially a society that just doesn't function, then I wonder whether a question to ask, and this returns to my initial observation, is whether we need a reset. And if indeed there is a substantial Afghan constituency for peace, if not for reform, then, and this is the question, how much do you hear in your travels of people of ordinary Afghans at all levels saying, we're ready for a process that gets us peace, not at any cost, but probably at a cost that the U.S. and its allies are not willing to contemplate?
My name is John Rothenberg. As Andrew knows, one of my most cherished beliefs is that a skilled Afghan is an Afghan that's less likely to be a Taliban and to some extent less likely to support the growing of the oligarchy. Last year I advised the Ministry of Labor and Social Affairs on the first nationwide urban labor market survey, and I found that less than 1% of the Afghan urban population have had any vocational training at all. And half of those were in software, which is an interesting thing. I did a similar kind of, at least for that question, a similar kind of survey in Balochistan in the early 90s. And in the camps in Balochistan, there were more than 2% that had been vocationally trained. So more than twice as much. And now there's all these private training institutions. So there's two questions, I guess, to this. Why has it gone down so significantly? And the second one is, do you all think that skilled Afghans are less likely to be a contribution to the criminal element or the Taliban?
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Amazi Afghan. I'm a Fulbright student from Afghanistan and also an intern with CSIS. There are some useful comments, especially I like the resetting issue. But I would like to say about resetting and then linking it with a young generation in Afghanistan. Because if we look across the history of some countries like Turkey, Iran, Egypt, and Pakistan, we'll find that youth in these countries had much say in making their nations, and also they were supported by their elders. But in case of Afghanistan, where the young generation is always discouraged of such contribution, either due to lack of resources or the very conservative political culture that classify young people as immature for change, I see a misty picture of our quick and efficient governance. Since you fellows have been researching on this, on the prospects of governance in Afghanistan, I would like to hear from you, are there any plans for the young generation of Afghanistan contributing in Afghan governance? And for me, as a young person from Afghanistan, I think I am born for the reconstruction of Afghanistan. I will die for it. And I swear after going back to Afghanistan, I will not let Afghanistan go down. And if there is support from international community, given that, and I have that I see that energy inside all the young Afghan people in Afghanistan, the young people, I mean, and I want to rebuild Afghanistan through the young people of Afghanistan. So I want to hear, is there anything, how do you see the young generation contributing to the Afghan governance?
Well, let's start with the last question, and that was a fascinating question. In terms of dealing with youth, it's a mixed blessing. We all would love to see the vision that you just began to sketch out.
I have a project for us.
Well, and if I had some money, I'd be glad to contribute it. I don't. I don't think anybody knows where this is going to go. We talked a little bit. We didn't use the word political will, but we talked about people organizing in a political fashion to give voice to their interests. If there are enough young, motivated people like yourself who can begin to organize and mobilize as a constituency for reform, that could be the catalyst that we have all been looking for. Is that going to happen? Well, I don't know. History...
Yeah, it is definitely going to happen.
Well.
If there is support, that is the main thing. Like, I can't do it in Afghanistan, you know, alone with all these warlords.
Okay, let's keep in mind, history has not been kind to Afghanistan. And if you look at that sort of 40-40-40 paradigm that I was suggesting, 40 million Afghans, 40% unemployed, 40% urbanized. You know, there's a few of you who are Fulbright scholars. We wish there were lots more. I personally would like to see some sort of an urban CCC program so people were put to work in the urban areas. We would all like to see more education. But what often happens in these countries, including Afghanistan, including Pakistan, is people go, they get educated, they come back, and there's no jobs. And that's where I get really concerned. So I can only encourage you to continue with what you sketched out. And it's a wonderful vision, and if it works, we will all be extremely grateful, and particularly your country would be immensely beholden to you and people like yourself. And good luck.
Yeah, just to reiterate that perspective we just heard is, I think, very common when you're talking to youth in Afghanistan, and I think it is a great overlooked portion of the society there. We know very little about, in general, what Afghan youth are thinking. Unfortunately, some of the things we do hear in places out of Kabul University is that, you know, the main politics there are along ethnic lines and radical lines. And I think it's an area where we do need a lot more research. And I think the frustration of the much better educated Afghan youth than their elders is something that you hear very frequently in Afghanistan. In terms of your comment on vocational training, I mean, obviously, certainly, I think that that's an important thing. We need more of it. I wouldn't, however, conclude that people who are more skilled are necessarily not going to join the Taliban. I mean, I think that we need evidence for that before we can read that conclusion. I think there's too many assumptions made that poor people, you know, join the Taliban. We have a lot of poor people in Afghanistan who haven't joined the Taliban, and I think we need, you know, some of these assumptions, I think, are simplistic, and I think... But you hear it often in the press. Oh, well, you know, the Taliban pay them this, and therefore people are joining the Taliban. I think there are some examples of that, no doubt. I don't think we know the scale of it. And I think we need to understand what are the drivers of conflict to a much greater extent. And, I mean, that's something I should have highlighted in my research. I'm certainly not saying there is nowhere where an aid project can have some benefits. I mean, if your conflict, say, up in Fadiab is the drought and water resources, and there's significant conflict at the local level over some water resources, well, you know, a smart aid program in that context to try to address that, I think, can have some conflict mitigation benefits. In general, though, talking in terms of the insurgency, which I think there's a lot of different things you can attribute it to. I think the role of Pakistan is maybe there's an ideological dimension of it for some. There's a drug economy dimension. There's tribal dimensions. There's intertribal. I mean, there's a whole range of factors, I think, contributing to the insurgency. I don't see a lot of evidence, though, that its lack of physical infrastructure has been I know you're not talking about it. I'm saying a tendency, therefore, that if we do more infrastructure, it could have a benefit. So I think it's in that context that I was raising is the nature of my research. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
The question is, what kind of constituency is there within Afghanistan for reform? Of course, there are people who want reform and want peace. They're not strong, and the institutional structures for them are also quite weak, and the processes are quite weak. So the parliament is not a strong institution, and it tends to be also captured by zero-sum trade-offs, immediate trade-offs for immediate payoffs. And that kind of nexus that we were talking about between illicit drugs, between kidnapping, crime, etc., plus the government is the thing that is particularly disheartening, I think, about the scene. And unless there's a constituency that can be built, which has some power, some force, not of course there are plenty of people, but what's the center of gravity there? Where is the institutional procedural leverage that those folks have against what is clearly a quite lucrative alternative for those that are in positions of power? It's hard to see how you're going to break out of this cycle, and I don't think the international actors are going to be able to do that or should be doing it. It's got to be done, it seems to me, by Afghan actors, and you can get help for that, but you can't replace a local constituency with some kind of institutional and procedural capacity to move in that direction. And so, again, the zero-sum lack of trust that has been built up as a result of the degradation of traditional mechanisms without being replaced by modern systems of accountability and accountable governance and checks and balances, it seems to us, has left the field to people who will use it for their own personal benefit. And to me, I come back to these three things that Afghans talked about almost universally. Where is the security? Where is the justice? And where is the good governance? And it seems to me those are the three pegs that I think people need to keep, you know, front and center. More even than some of the other economic development, et cetera, issues, because those are the ones that I think could build the development, but more importantly, that's what clearly Afghans are saying is the problem. And if those problems aren't addressed, then it's hard to see how the rest of them gets built up. Well, I hope we've provoked some thoughts and some controversy, and thank you very much for coming.